How many people can tell you what it was like on Omaha Beach on D-Day? You'll meet one of them today at 1 on Hometown Heroes.
I think the biggest problem was seeing so many bodies. It was a real disaster. Yeah. Most of my buddies were gone.
This 89-year-old Hanford man survived, and he'll share his story today at 1 on News Talk 580 and FM 105.9, brought to you by Humana, proud to honor our hometown heroes.
As Americans, we enjoy many freedoms. Among them are the freedom to vote, to worship, and to speak our mind. These freedoms have long been protected by the men and women of our armed forces and their families that supported them. For more than 15 years, Humana has made a commitment to our veteran community. That commitment continues today with the introduction of the Humana Preventive Plus package for veterans and their families. In developing this product, we listened to more than 10,000 veterans. With their input and our 50 years of expertise in the healthcare industry, we developed an affordable dental plan that also includes discounts on vision, hearing, retail prescription drugs, and more. We are proud to offer this plan to our veterans and their families right here in Fresno and throughout the country. We are also proud to announce that Humana is now the 2012 exclusive healthcare partner for the MVETS. Find out more about the Humana Preventive Plus package for veterans. Call our Fresno office, 559-221-2522, 559-221-2522.
News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom.
Hometown Heroes is brought to you by Humana. Humana is proud to honor our hometown heroes.
Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday on KMJ, whether you listen to us at 580 AM or 105.9 on the FM side of your dial, maybe even online at kmjnow.com. You know that each week we catch up with veterans, mostly from the World War II generation. We want to hear their stories, first of all. We want them to know how much we appreciate their service and sacrifice, and that it's important to us their stories are not forgotten, not lost with the sands of time. And we're going to hear quite a story today that not too many people can tell, especially these days, from David McCoy, 89 years old, of Hanford, California, but originally an Okie from Muskogee. Now, there's a little piece of history that not too many people know about these days. You came out as a young boy in the wake of the Dust Bowl. What do you remember about that journey west? Was it an adventure for you?
Yeah, it was quite a trip. We had a big farm in, right out of Muskogee, and we had a big sale and sold out in 1936. And, of course, my dad went and bought a brand-new Ford truck with big racks on it and threw all of us kids in the back with the bedding and the clothing and off to California.
So years later, when you watch television and you see the Beverly Hillbillies or you watch something like Grapes of Wrath or something like that, when you see that truck loaded up, that's the real thing. That's what it was like for you?
That was the real thing, the real Grapes of Wrath.
Were you nervous, concerned about what you might find once you got here?
No, not really. I was still young, and a bunch of us kids in there. There was eight of us boys and three girls in the truck, and we was looking for fruit country. We didn't want to go to a cotton country because we were tired of picking cotton. But we did end up around Selma at a farm out there. A guy had a house available, and we run across a guy in Bakersfield when we stopped to get some lunch, and he said he had a house available and needed some pickers. So we moved right around Selma and started picking cotton.
So you weren't able to avoid the cotton the way you wanted to. Is that hard work for a young man?
No, it wasn't too bad in those days. In those days, you know, kids lived on a farm. They raised up to work and to do things, and nowadays the kids don't get to do anything.
Yeah, maybe we should go back to some of those practices. I think I know how you feel about it. And once you got in the military, you would do a lot of driving. Did you start driving on the farm? Is that where you learned?
Well, yeah, I started driving way back when I was in school, because when we came out here, I started a school, a little school called Central School out at Caneo and Temperance. So I got a job there while I was in grammar school there as a custodian. So I worked my way through, and my parents left me and went back to Oklahoma. So I left, been on my own ever since about 13 years of age.
Holy smokes. Try that one on for size if you're 13 years old out there right now. And you graduated from Selma High School in 1941, so you're already out of school by the time the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. What were you doing at that time, and how do you remember finding out?
After school, after Selma High, I went up to Berklee College for a little while to take up a business course, And I was only there for a couple months, and then I went to work up in San Francisco. And I think I was in San Francisco working when Pearl Harbor happened, but I did go to work for Richmond Shipyard, and I went to school at Richmond Shipyard to be a welder, so I was a certified welder for a while. And then later on, I got called to sign up for the service, so I had to go down to Exeter, California, and sign up.
When you heard about Pearl Harbor, was that a big shock to you that your country had been attacked?
Very much so. I couldn't believe what happened, why we were asleep and let it happen, but it did happen, and it was quite a shock to me.
And when you realized that you were going to have to do something about it, that like so many other young men in America, you were going to have to go fight somebody somewhere, did you have an idea of what you wanted to do in the military?
No, not really. I wanted to get in and do the best I could, so when I went into training in Fort Sill, Oklahoma, I took up artillery. I specialized in the artillery field, and then I started to have a little problem in walking, and so then I started to take over driving. So then I went through driving school, and I ended up being a truck driver for the Army.
And driving and transportation was kind of a theme the rest of your life, huh?
Yeah, pretty much. That's what I did all the time, because after training in Fort Sill and went to Fort Meade, Maryland, I become a platoon leader. I ended up as a corporal, and I was platoon leader. And then when we went overseas, I took over driving trucks.
And you were part of a day that has been called a lot of things. I think most famously, the longest day on June 6th of 1944. But before we get to that day, anything that happened from the time that you joined the service to the time you went overseas that you remember really clearly as something to remember?
Oh, not too much, just the regular training in the service. You have to go through all the boot camp and everything else.
What about when you went overseas? They took you to England, and you're going over as part of the 18th Infantry Regiment of the 1st Division. They take you to England. For a guy from Oklahoma who spent some time in the San Joaquin Valley, what was it like showing up in England?
It was fun. We left on the ship and headed over to Liverpool, and of course the big convoy going over there, we was in about a five-day storm, and you could see a ship, and then you disappear because the waves are so high. And one of our aircraft carriers lost the airplanes off of the ship on the way over, and we had some submarines that came up into our convoy, and they had to drop out some bombs for them. We get into Liverpool at about midnight and unload us, and we had to go up the cobble brick streets and walked, and we got up a certain area and got on a railroad car, and they took us on up by Weymouth and Dorchester, England. And while we were up there, there was a big camp, and we did all of our training and stuff there, getting ready for combat.
And is there anything that can really prepare you for what combat is like?
Yeah, we got pretty much prepared in England, and of course, I was in the transportation part. We had to take our vehicles down and put them in the ocean and waterproof them and get all set. We did a lot of training and everything in England before we headed over there.
How clear of a picture did you guys have of what you were about to do? Because now we can look back in history and we say, hey, D-Day, June 6th, and the Allies attacked the Germans at Normandy, and that was a turning point in the war. But for you guys, before this happened, did you have any clue?
We had an idea of what combat would be like, but we got a lot of bombing and everything while we were in England. In fact, some of my buddies that trained with me got killed in England while we were training there, because they had come over and dropped bombs on us there in Dorchester, England.
What did that do to you, to your mindset, seeing your friends die? I mean, does it make you question whether you're going to make it home someday?
Well, the idea we had in combat was that we weren't going to make it home. That's the way we felt, the way we was involved in the battle and everything else. We just figured do the best we can because we didn't think we'd make it home.
Was it hard for you to be so far away from your family, or were you used to that since they moved back to Oklahoma when you were 13?
Oh, I was used to that, you know. It really didn't disturbed me too much. I kept in touch with my mother most of the time when I could. I had sent some mail home to my mother, and this is while we were way up in combat. I sent some stuff to my mother, and after I mailed it, about two or three days later, they told us if you mailed anything, forget it, because the ship got sunk. So my mother didn't get anything that I sent her.
Yeah, it sure is a different world we live in today, and you're giving us an idea of what the world was like back then. So you knew what you guys were going over to do and that you would be bringing the war to the Germans where they were in Europe. Tell me about when you found out that the time had finally come, that you guys were going across the channel and this was it. You were going in.
Well, we were notified to prepare to go on a certain day. And, of course, then they called it off because the weather was too bad. And it's a good thing we didn't go that particular day because the Germans was thinking we were coming that particular day, and we didn't. So we went the next day, but the next day it was kind of rough because a lot of the guys got sick on the ship. I was on what they call a LST, where you load a lot of equipment and stuff, only a few troops on it. You get over there, and they drop a ramp, and you go off into the water and get onto the beach. So it was a rough deal going over that day we did, but the Germans had already moved out some of their troops because we didn't come the day we were supposed to, so it kind of helped us a bit.
Yeah, and there was another twist of fate that would help you out in your situation, but you mentioned driving a truck off the LST. What kind of truck was that? What was it carrying? How big was it?
It's an armored half-track ammunition carrier. I was loaded with ammunition. So I had to get off and get onto the beach, and I had to wait on the beach to make sure I got my four guns off, my four artillery pieces, if they got stranded in the water, because the water was still pretty deep, because when I got off, it come all the way up into my floorboard. And I had to wait on the sand to make sure I got my four guns off. If you understand what 4th of July is, it was 4th of July and then some.
And I want to touch on that. Let's come back to it. But before that, you were initially supposed to be one of the first ships getting there. You're supposed to be part of the first wave of American forces hitting the beach at Omaha Beach on D-Day?
That's correct. We were supposed to be in there, but we couldn't get in because the Navy would drop the anchor, and when he went to the end, he'd tell us to get off. Well, the first time he dropped it, we put one big truckload of ammunition off, and it went completely under. So they pulled out again, came back in the second time. We let some guys test the water, and they went under. So we pulled out, and our commander told the Navy commander, you either get us in this time, or we're going to throw you overboard. I mean, we had to get in. So the third time was when my eye came off. Then I got off, like I say, and then I had to wait to get my four artillery pieces off.
So this is about, about noontime or early afternoon on D-Day?
No, it was just before noon.
Just before noon. And the people who did get in there at 6 o'clock in the morning got a very rude welcome, and it sounds like it wasn't very pleasant for you. You said 4th of July, and I think that tells us a little bit. Can you give us a sense of what you saw and what you heard as you drove that truck off that LST?
Well, even before I drove it off, we heard all the shells. The Germans did a lot of airburst. It was terrible before we got off, and hated to get off and go into all of that. But
and for people at home that weren't there and don't get what you're saying when you say an airburst, explain to us what that is and why that's so deadly and dangerous.
Well, it's a big shell that they fire at you, and it blows up in the air so that all the shrapnel will hit whoever's below, you know. Before I got off, I had binoculars, and I was looking over at one of the troop ships that was sitting there. It had got in there, and the tide went out, and it was sitting up in the sand, and the troops were getting off, and I saw these troops going down the ramp, and they was falling off in the water about halfway down the ramp, and I kept looking, and I saw something, and then I spotted a machine gun up on a hill that was shooting the troops as he's coming down the ramp. I told my commander, and he called the destroyer escort that was right around us, and they spotted the machine gun, and they fired three shells. One shell went above it, one went below it, and one blew it up. We could see it blow up, and it set up there shooting our troops as they was coming off the ship.
Well, and I know you're not looking for the glory or a pat on the back here, but it sounds like you probably saved a lot of lives by spotting that and pointing it out to them. And that's hard to talk about, I know, when you think about that. Maybe your own life was one of the ones saved in that process.
When I got my half-track off onto the sand and was just waiting, I was under heavy fire at the time. While I was sitting there waiting, one of the troops was laying over there rolling, and I got out and went over and asked, are you hit? Are you hurt? And I noticed it was a one-star general, and he was on our ship when I didn't know he was on there. And I said, are you hurt? No, I got to get this life belt off. We got to leave it on the beach. And I said, USB, get the hell out of here. So I kicked him and told him to go. And he run over to that ship, And just as I got my guns off, that ship blew up. So I don't know whether that general got killed or not. I never seen him after that. But we were getting heavy fire as I was coming off, real heavy. And some of the troops that we had on ship with us, they would get on the barrels of the gun as it's coming off and ride. And some of the air bursts knocked them off, and some of them got run over, and some of them got killed as it was coming off.
And I'm just trying to imagine, and I see the emotion in your eyes all these years later. I'm trying to imagine how you keep going in a situation like that. How do you, I mean, you said that you didn't expect to make it through, but that kind of cements it for you, doesn't it?
Yeah, it sure did. I was concerned because the half-track was solid armor, but if I would have got an airburst right over it with all the ammunition I was carrying, it was a death trap.
You would have blown here to smithereens. So you were unable to get on the beach and unload all your guns?
Yes, we got all the guns off of the beach. We got them up into position, and we pulled up the valley and got up on a hill and got settled down for the evening. I pulled a half track up on a hill and found a spot, and I dug like a grave, and then I drove my front wheels of my half track right over the grave, and then I slid under the grave, and I slept in there overnight, and I was still getting bullets fired at me, but they couldn't hit me because I was down in there. There was a German across a hedgerow. During the night, he'd fire, and the bullets would hit the hedgerow, and it'd go poop, poop. And at daylight, our troops come by and shot the guy just over the hedgerow. But then they go on to a little building that was there, and there was a person at little building that was directing the traffic for the Germans on the beach, and they shot the person. After they shot the person, they turned him over, and it was a woman. A German woman directing all the fire on the beach. They had guns sitting in there about 5 miles in, shooting the big shells on the beach.
Well, and we're getting a taste of why June 6, 1944 has been called the longest day. And when you describe where you spent that night, and you talked about digging the grave and then parking your half track over it so nothing could get in that. Did someone teach you to do that, or is that just something you thought up?
Oh, that's something you do. You either dig a foxhole or you dig a grave, something you can get in. So I thought the easiest way was to dig that so I could lay in it at night. And I pulled a half-track front wheels over it because the back wheels are all like caterpillar wheels. Right. So I had a good place to stay overnight.
But I imagine you didn't get much sleep.
No, I didn't get much sleep. I got a little bit of shut-eye, but not much.
And how do you wake up the next day ready to do anything after you've endured that? I mean, when they say the longest day, is that what it felt like to you?
Yeah, it was a long day, all right. I don't think we even was concerned about it. It was just so much action going on. And, of course, I didn't have any trouble waking up because all the fire going up all around me that next morning at daylight. So no problem.
So his first taste of combat came on Omaha Beach on D-Day. Imagine yourself in that scenario for a moment. Yeah, it's pretty hard to fathom, isn't it? There's more to David McCoy's story, and we'll explore it with this 89-year-old veteran of the 1st Infantry Division's 18th Infantry Regiment when Hometown Heroes continues next on KMJ. Hey, this is Paul Leffler, and if you've been listening to KMJ for any length of time, you've probably heard me wax poetic about my hometown of Las Banas at one point or another. Every city has its secrets, and I'm going to fill you in on one my old neighbors have been keeping for 40 years. No matter where you live in the valley, you probably go through Las Banas every once in a while. So next time you're cruising down the 152, pull into Ming's Restaurant. The owner, Paul Cito, has been showing off his skills in the kitchen there since 1968. He has perfected the best Mongolian beef this side of the Great Wall. Delicate rice noodles underneath tender slices of beef with a flavor I can't even put into words. Whether you prefer mild, medium, or spicy, you'll be coming back for more. Ming's is closed on Mondays, so don't say I didn't warn you. But stop in any other day and try the pork wonton soup, Chinese chicken salad, or get everyone's attention with the sizzling chicken and vegetables. The possibilities are endless, but they all have one thing in common. Ming's time-tested commitment to taking your taste buds on a thrill ride. Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in Las Banas.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. You know, there are not too many people left who can tell us firsthand what it was like on June 6th, 1944, a day in which 2,500 Americans, 2,500 on that day alone, gave their lives in a brutal clash along Normandy's coast. Our guest today, David McCoy, came ashore on the bloodiest beach, Omaha Beach. His outfit, the 18th Infantry Regiment, suffered heavy losses that day. We're thankful he survived and is here to tell us about it.
I don't want to make you dwell on the stuff that's difficult to dwell on, but for those of us who weren't there and didn't experience it, what was the most difficult thing for you to witness that day?
I think the biggest problem was seeing so many bodies. It was a real disaster. Yeah. Most of my buddies were gone. Later on, about a week after we got in and so forth, well, maybe 2 weeks, I was still driving a half track, and on my half track, I had a machine gun, a 50 caliber and a 30 caliber. The chaplain got on with me, and we were going to see about burying some bodies. So we pulled up this one place and got out, and we dug a grave for this body, and we was getting ready to put him in it. We had his tag and his helmet we was going to put on a stick there. We got ready to roll him in, and all hell broke loose. There was a bunch of Germans dug in on the hedgerow over on the side that our troops had already passed by, and they started firing at us. And the chaplain says, "Hell with that Heinle, let's get out of here." So we left him, and we went and got in the half track, and they was firing at us. I get the 30 caliber machine gun and started firing back. 30 caliber don't do any good. So I rolled a 50 caliber around, and I fired it, and the Germans came out from the hedgerow. I think there's about 10 or 12 of them come out and surrendered. We held them there and called for backup, and they came and took them back. And then later after that, I went on up a ways further with our tanks. I think we had six tanks, and we was pulling into this field, and we was going to go in and park in the field. We get inside of there and run right into a big old Panther tank, and we had to get the hell out of there. And as we go out, our troops loaded up on the tanks, and the tanks come out, and they spun so fast in the road that one of the machine gunners in one of the tanks got thrown over, and he pulled the trigger, and he shot some of the soldiers on the tank in front of us. And I went out with a half track and tore up a bunch of communication lines as I was getting the hell out of there. Then it wasn't long after that until the commander's driver got injured, and the commander didn't have a driver, so nobody wanted to drive him because his Jeep has to stay right on the front line. So I told him if they get somebody to drive my death trap, I would take over. So I took over driving for the commander.
So you preferred driving the Jeep, even if you were on the front lines, to driving that half track?
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah, it was tough, but I enjoyed it more than I did driving a half track.
I know that this is all, at this point, every day probably is new experiences for you and things you've never seen before. But being with the regimental commander like that, did you get a different perspective on what was going on and what the war looked like to you?
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. I was involved with every bit of it. Sometimes I would be in a place where he'd tell me, "Don't you move until I call you." And I didn't get along with the captain or the major, and they was always trying to get after me. Every time they turned around to get after me, and of course I would go to the old man, which my commander, and tell him what's happened. And when I'd see them get out of line, I'd tell the commander, and he'd go over and chew them out, and they knew what was going on. So we had a battle between the major and the captain. The major was a big guy with a big goatee. All he'd do is pat his foot and twist his goatee and say, "Corporal McCoy, you do this." And, you know, so he sent me on a deal one time. I almost got killed, and the commander, oh, man, he got after him.
Almost got killed. That sounds like another one of your close calls, huh?
Yeah, they hit my Jeep, blew a tire, knocked a tree down across my Jeep, and I managed to get away.
How'd you pull that off with a tree down over your Jeep?
Well, with the four-wheel drive, I managed to get out from under it, but still I had a flat tire. So I finally got down under a railroad track and had to put on a spare tire.
Well, see, I thought you were going to tell us that you were such a great driver that you had the same Jeep the entire way through the rest of the war.
Yeah.
Trying to be lighthearted with stuff that's still painful. I apologize. But no. You had three Jeeps?
Lost three Jeeps. Yeah, got all blown up, but luckily we didn't get hurt. The last one, like I say, P-51 and 47s were told to shoot anything in the area. And we had smoke screens and flares and everything else, and they came down and hit our Jeep. But the old man and I was in a ditch, so we were okay. So we didn't get hurt.
I realize this could be a needle in the haystack here, but of all the situations like that where it came close to your number being called, What's the one that took your breath away the most, or the one you think back on now and say, man, I was really fortunate to survive that?
Well, there was so many of them. One that really got me was we were searching a house. I started over to the window to raise the window, and one of my guys knocked me down. And I, what the hell you knocked me down for? He says, see that booby trap? So if I'd opened the window, I'd have got hit with a booby trap. Well, then as I go out the door, they had gone out, and just as I stepped out, a mortar landed right beside me at the door, but it was one of our mortars that hit the roof and slid off, and it was a dud. And they had to move me. I couldn't move. They had to come and get me.
I'd be frozen stiff, too. And I've had a few other veterans tell me stories like that where a dud landed right next to them. I imagine you're frozen there because you're still waiting for it to go off, right?
Oh, it scared me. I couldn't move. It's one of those things.
When you finally realize that it is a dud and that you dodged that bullet, literally, what goes through your mind? Are you giving thanks to somebody? Are you just taking a deep breath, a sigh of relief? What do you do?
I don't really think about it. I know it's just one of those things. If I go, I go. And, you know, you're in combat, and you never know when it's going to go. We were standing around behind the openings on a 105 Hollister, one of the artillery pieces, and a bunch of us are standing there talking, and one of the buddies said, I'm going to take a nap, and he laid over there and went to sleep. All of a sudden, in come shells. Wow, big air burst, and it didn't hit any of us, but we said, hey, he didn't even wake up. So we go over and pull the cover off of him, and he's all blown up. And that's how close it came to us. Just a lot of things like that happen. I was in so many different places to where that I'm just lucky to be here.
And I imagine spending so much time at the beck and call of your regimental commander that you probably ended up with a pretty special relationship with him. What did you appreciate about him and the way he did his job?
The commander was very good. He was a good commander, and he was good to me. He tried to protect me, too, because when we got into some of the major battles, sometimes he would direct me where to go and stay. He tried to keep me out of it, and I think he did.
What was his name?
Colonel John Williams. He made full Eagle right at the end of the war. He was Lieutenant Colonel. We was in another area to where that the major's driver got captured one night, and my commander asked me to go out to the outpost and take some message out there. So I go out there, and on the way up this road, I heard all of the bullets flying, and man, I was driving as fast as I could. It was after dark, and I was driving fast as I could, bullets flying all over the place. And I got to the outpost. The sergeant says, oh, don't go back that road. That road had been captured that I came up. So you take this other road and go back in. So, okay, so I took this road, and I get down there, and a big old tank blocking my road. Well, the tank moved over, and I thought it was our big old tank, you know, and I get back. And the old man says, which road did you go out? And I told him, he's, oh, hell, that road's been taken because the major's driver was captured. They captured him and said, you come back to the other road? Yeah. Did you see a tank? I said, yeah, it moved over and let me come by. He said, that's a big German Panther. We have nothing to knock him out. We're trying to let him get out and get into the front so we can get the Air Force to get him tomorrow. So the next day, the Air Force got him. He got in front, and the Air Force got him.
Little did you know, you were really a sitting duck for him if he wanted you.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Well, you were there on D-Day, and you've shared some of those emotional moments there. And you were also involved in, really, the war in Europe, the other pivotal point, the Battle of the Bulge. How did you experience that? Were you there at the start of it, or did you come in after that had begun?
We had just got into holding position, and the first time we'd had a break. So we had got set up at this little town in Belgium, and we was going to have about 4 or 5 days off. We just got set up, and I think we were there about 2 days, and they dropped paratroopers on us. Then that was the beginning of the Battle of Bulge. And what had happened, we had another outfit to come in and relieve us and hold the front line. What this other outfit did, they were driving around up there on the front line with the lights on. The only lights we ever used is little cat eyes. But they were driving around up there if no war was going on. And the Germans sitting out there getting ready for us. So then all hell broke loose. Those troops started to leave. We practically had to pull guns on them to make them turn around and fight with us. And the commanders of those troops, they got into a lot of trouble because it made it real bad for us. And we had went a hell of a time up in there. And with the cold ice and snow and everything else, it was really bad.
Well, and that's what I wanted to ask you about, because the battle conditions sound chaotic and, and similar to some of the other stuff you've endured, but the added dimension of the coldest winter they had had ever. How hard was it to stay warm and to keep your fingers and your toes?
We had some heavy equipment, but it wasn't heavy enough, but we had to do a lot of moving around. You know, you can't stay in one spot. But then when you get into a foxhole and get down under a bit, you'd be surprised the foxhole doesn't get as cold as you think it would. So if you dig down and get below the surface, you're all right. But trying to dig it with a little shovel, and we had to do that.
And ice.
Yeah, and of course, you know, we got cut off a food supply, and we starved for a while. We eat weeds and grass when we could find it, so it was tough. It was tough. So I lost a lot of weight. I was down to about 110 pounds when I got a discharge.
And how much did you weigh going in?
About 160.
And a lot of that was because of the Battle of the Bulge?
Yeah, right, Battle of the Bulge. I didn't follow up on the deal the first night that we left France and entered into Belgium. That was a tough one. There was a forest there just before you get into Belgium. Well, we had planes to bomb that forest all day long. They must have bombed that thing for 18 hours. And then we had to go ahead to go through. When we start to go through, the road was all blocked with horses dead, wagons. They had horses and wagons and guns and stuff, equipment. So we had a big bulldozer with a blade on it to clear a road for us. Well, from the forest to the little town was about a quarter of a mile. The ground was level like a lawn out there. They'd sowed oats or wheat or barley or something. It was like a lawn. It was nice and smooth from the forest to the town. We get into the town. The French people says, beaucoup bush, which is a lot of Germans out in the forest. Well, though they can't be, because we killed them all. So we didn't take their word for it. Normally, we set up a roadblock behind us, and we set up roadblocks around the town. So we got set up in there. Well, must have been a little after midnight, and it was so dark you couldn't hardly see your hand in front of you. All hell broke loose. The Germans was coming out of the forest. Well, we had a machine gun nest set up, and my buddy, my best buddy that took training with me, was in the machine gun nest, he and one other kid. So anyway, he was firing. The commander, we had set up in a little, like in a little barn there that night, and he come out, and so much fire was coming from the Germans, and we were getting overrun a bit. And the commander hollered out, everybody fire, everything you got, fire, everybody. Just fire in the air, everybody, let all the fire you can. So everybody opened up fire. And then it was just about to get into day, just a little about a daybreak. With all of that firepower, some of our people had already got shot and so forth, we saw a white flag coming out of the forest. So the commander sent two guys down there. Well, the commander of the Germans wanted to surrender to get help, because my buddy on the machine guns out in that field looked like he'd sowed grass seeds. That's how the bodies were laying. And they surrendered and came in. They outnumbered us three times. And it was some of the Germans says, we wished we would have known that. Because we were about ready to surrender, because we called for help, but it would take a full day to get help. So anyway, they surrendered and we took them over.
So your friend on the machine gun was so effective and efficient, he gave them the impression you guys had a lot more than you really had.
Right. They shot him three times and his buddy three times. He killed them both right there. Yeah. As we came into the town was a nice, neat little town. It had a nice street. There was about eight brand new ambulances, German ambulances, lined up down the street. No drivers. We open them up. They're all loaded with ammunition.
That makes you angry, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, because we found out early in the go, though, that one time we was going to let the Germans come out and pick up their body, and they come out with the ambulance, and they turn around like they're heading back, open the door, and fired. So then we knew to not trust the German ambulance.
That's where they come up with that saying, all's fair in love and war, I suppose. And we've heard stories of German soldiers disguised in American uniforms and all that. I want to get back to that circumstance, because you talked about your friend on the machine gun, and you mentioned that he died in the process. Seems to me that, you know, when you think about heroes of World War II and more than 400,000 Americans who didn't come home, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but that's somebody you probably have a lot of respect for.
Yeah, that's for sure. That's for sure. I haven't run across too many World War II guys, but we lost a lot of them.
And again, I don't want to say anything that's not the case, but it kind of sounds like he and that other man really gave their lives and in the process saved a lot of yours.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Being a soldier, you're going to protect your buddies. And, of course, they protect us, too, you know. And if you're on a outpost and you get hit, you got to do what you have to do.
In the midst of all this, I know you told me before that your general thinking was, if I make it, I make it. If I don't, I don't. But did you ever have a moment where you really thought, this is it, I'm not going to wake up tomorrow?
Oh, not really, but just one of those things you never know what's going to happen from minute to minute.
Did you have a clear sense of what you were fighting for and why it was important to do what you were doing?
Well, I think most of us were thinking it was a political war. Hitler wanted to expand. I think the population got so great that he was trying to take over more areas and had too many people to feed, and I think it was political war. That's what we thought.
Did you guys have any clue at that point what he had been doing to the Jews and all the concentration camps, the death camps?
Yes, we did. We heard all about it, knew all about it, and we learned a lot from his SS soldiers that he trained, because they would do anything to try to shoot you and so forth, because they said that we will die for the fewer. They would die for Hitler, and a few of them did die for Hitler. When we captured them, a few of them did die for Hitler. We'd tell them, be sure they don't have any guns on them or anything, and we'd line them up, and most of the time the SS troops would have guns and stuff on them, and they wouldn't drop them. When we go to march them back to the rear echelon, you know, to put them in holding, a lot of them didn't make it.
That's the way it was. Break time again. Our candid conversation with 89-year-old David McCoy of Hanford will continue next. We heard about what he experienced with the Big Red Ones, 18th Infantry Regiment on Omaha Beach on D-Day, but he also spent some time with the man who oversaw Operation Overlord, the general who would go on to become our 34th president. We'll get those memories when Hometown Heroes continues next on KMJ. Hey, Bulldog fans, Paul Leffler here, coming to you not as the voice of the dogs, but as a husband and father of two. Ever have a hard time finding a restaurant that's family-friendly, won't set you back a week's pay, and has the kind of food that makes you want to keep coming back? I think I found it. And no, it's not one of those chains. It's one of a kind. Luna's Pizzeria, an Italian restaurant on Pulaski Avenue in Old Town Clovis. The Liberta family's been serving up great, authentic Italian food in the heart of cowboy country for more than 40 years. The pizza dough is made from scratch daily, and so is the bread. You won't forget the bread. I'm a sucker for that bread and the meatballs and the ravioli. And hey, did I say family friendly? How do you top a kid's menu with nothing over $3.95, drink included? I'm not making that up. See for yourself at lunasclovis.com. And while you're there, check out the family meal deals. That's lunasclovis.com or 299-4141. Tell them I sent you. And if you really want to, bring me back some bread. Luna's Pizzeria and Italian Restaurant. You'll love it at Luna's. A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis. Its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K through 12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 89-year-old David McCoy of Hanford in Kings County. I want to thank his chiropractor, Chuck Wynn, for introducing me to him. Remember, if there's a veteran in your life you think I ought to catch up with, call me here at KMJ or email me, paul@kmjnow.com. It's easy. Back to David McCoy now. He served with the 18th Infantry Regiment, part of the Big Red One, the 1st Infantry Division during World War II. Well, he made it through the Battle of the Bulge, and I'm sure you've never experienced anything like that since. But from that point, you still have another 4 months until the war's over in Europe. What were you doing all that time?
Yeah, we were still chasing the Germans and fighting them and all the way, and we ended up down in the old Sudetenland in Czechoslovakia. We were held up in Princess Metternich's chateau in Czechoslovakia. When the war ended, that's where we were, and it was 10 miles between us and the Russians, had the Germans right in the middle. As soon as it ended, my commander and a bodyguard and another person, we got on a jeep and went across to the Russians and had a little visit with them and came back. And then a few days later, my commander and the captain and the major and myself in a jeep, they went over and had a little party with the Russians. Everything was sort of shaping up, but of course the Germans was telling us that the Russians are going to fight us, you know, which, no, they weren't. That was where we was at when the war ended.
In the role that you had in driving your commander around, you had the opportunity to interact with one of the famous figures of World War II who would go on to become our president. What was your impression of Dwight David Eisenhower?
Wonderful person. Very nice. Called me in as a corporal and him a big general and wanted to talk to me. It was pretty nice of him.
And was that the first time you met him? The first time you were around him?
That's the first time I ever met him. That's when I took my commander over there to be with him and to meet him. And that was just as soon as the war ended. It wasn't when he was getting ready to come home. It was before.
And so he said, come on over here, have a drink with me.
Yeah, he called me in. Have a seat, have a drink with me. And I said, no, sir, I wouldn't care for one. Well, you're not driving, have a drink. But that night, right next door, they have a house where the drivers stay. And General Eisenhower has a Cadillac convertible, a sedan, a big white sedan Cadillac convertible. And he come over and asked me if I would drive the general out on a party that night. And sure, so I drove the general and I think another two-star general and a colonel all out on a party, and they had a good time.
Were you any more nervous or anxious driving all that brass around than you were with your colonel?
Nope, didn't bother me. Didn't faze me.
You've got some really interesting stories to tell, and like I said, there are very few people left who can tell us some of those things, and you're the only one that can tell us from your perspective. But you almost had another story to tell about flying home on General Eisenhower's plane. What happened there?
Well, when I took my commander over there, he took all of his gear and stuff. He was retiring, coming home, and he was flying home with General Eisenhower. So I took him over there, and the general says, Corporal, where's your gear? And I says, didn't bring it. Well, I got one seat left. Oh, good. I run back, got my stuff, come back over. He come up and he apologized. He says, I'm sorry, Corporal. This general here took your seat because there's death in the family and he has to go home. So he said, I'll see you when you get back to the States.
So you had to find another way to get home, huh?
Yeah, I had to find another way home.
Some guys have told me about coming home, and many of them sailing into New York Harbor and seeing the Statue of Liberty, and they get pretty emotional about it. I don't get the sense that you're too sentimental about that, huh?
No, I'm not. I'm just glad to get home. No, a lot of poker playing going on coming home. We had a good time coming home.
You had gone over as, I guess, a teenager, right? You would have been, what, 19 or 20 years old going over?
I turned 21 when I was overseas.
So I imagine you had a little different perspective on life back in the States after being through everything you went through. How was life different for you?
Hard to get used to it to come home because I ended up catching a train back out to Fresno. And then I went and spent a couple nights or so at my sister's house, her and her husband. But I couldn't sleep in the bed, so she found me sleeping in the floor. Because I couldn't sleep in the bed, so I'd lay on the floor and sleep. It was kind of hard to get used to it coming home.
I'm sure there are a lot of things that were hard to get used to. If you don't want to talk about this, you don't have to, but a lot of guys have told me about the burden that they carried for many years after the war of having flashbacks, waking up in the middle of the night, picturing those intense circumstances that you faced. Is that something that you've had to face in your life?
I did for a little while, but you finally get used to it. I mean, you get oriented again and get set up and doing your things, and you forget about it. Takes a while.
So you got back and went right to work and started a business, or what happened after you got home?
My sister and brother-in-law, they lived up around Vallejo. They moved out of Fresno up there, and I went up there and stayed with them. And my brother-in-law was working at the foundry in Vallejo, and I got a job at the foundry in Vallejo as a fireman and went to work. I was building a fire. When you say a fireman, what I was doing was putting wood on a big fire deal. We were building torpedo tubes, and you had to heat them. So I'd put a lot of wood on and get big fire, and that was my job. So I'd get the fire going, and I could go over and find me a place to take a nap. And when the fires would get low, a crane guy up above would drop a hook down them and wake me up. So I had a job there for quite a while. Quite a while later, I came back because I had gone to school under G.I. Bill. I went to school in L.A. in Inglewood, aircraft school, and I went for 1 year. You had to be in school for 1 year. I took up aircraft. I got federal license that I could work on any aircraft flying or any aircraft engine. Well, then before the school, right when my year was up, jet engine just came out. And I went 6 months school on jet engines. So I certified with federal license to work on any aircraft and any engine. Well, North American Aircraft picked me up after I got out of school because the airlines wanted you, but they don't pay anything. You know, they make you in charge about 20 people, 20 mechanics, and they pay you nothing. So North American Aircraft put me to work, and I worked with them for a long time, and finally I got through their whole production deal, and then I went back through and trained in the inspection, and then North American Aircraft opened a plant in Fresno, and they asked me to go to Fresno and take over the inspection department. So I was in charge of all of the inspection department at the Fresno plant. We were remodeling and redoing Korean jets that were wrecked.
Is there one thing that you're most proud of, or you think back on and say, yeah, I did something worthwhile?
Well, I think everything I did was worthwhile. You know, I'm here, I'm safe, and I tried to help everybody else out. Everything turned out real good. I didn't mention the first day that we entered into Germany. You know, we had to break through the Siegfried Line. They had that so well built that we had to get special engineers in there to bomb it out and bomb a path through. Well, we stayed over on the other side of the mountain from the German line and got ready to go into Germany the next night or the next day. It was a big forest, so we had to plow our way through a big forest and through the line that the engineers broke through for us, and we went into this little town which is called Eilendorf, and everybody was instructed that when we get into there, you better find a hiding place, because they're going to throw everything you can at us, because the other side of that town was a big hill, and they had their observation post up there, the Germans did. So anyway, we got ready to go early after midnight. We got into that little town and got set up, and the commander and the colonel and the major got in a basement, and there's a little alley there, and I had the Jeep there, and they were in the basement. The people next door had a basement, and I stayed there. And boy, all hell broke loose. My commander had to move out with the troops, and he had to take the hill. Well, my commander told me, you stay right here until I call for you. Don't move, don't move. So, okay, they was throwing everything at us. Well, the major and the captain looked out the window and saw my Jeep. They hollered at me, Corporal, get that Jeep undercover. Well, there was about a three-way street coming in there, and they were shelling the heck out of it. Well, across the street was a sort of like a brick building open. I run across the street with a Jeep and go in there, and all shells flying. Well, the house next door, there was a little girl, must about 10 years old or so, hollered, come is he here, you's be towed. Come here or you get killed. So I run across the street, and I go in the basement. So they told me that their aunt was living in the house next door. Well, when the shelling sort of eased up, I went next door, and I told the lady, I says, tonight you cannot live there. You got to go get in the basement. Oh, no, I don't live in my house. Says, yes, you're going to go get in the basement. So I forced her to get in the basement. Well, it was a good thing, because the next morning we look, and her whole bedroom, the whole house had blown apart. Everything is blown up. She'd have been killed. Well, she told me that she owned a liquor store down in Aachen, Germany. Well, Aachen is a big town. Aachen was 100% leveled. And the lady told me that she had this liquor store, and she drew me a map where it was. Anyway, a little later, the major and the captain called me and says, Corporal, take this here up to the colonel. I said, no, sir, I can't go till I get instruction from him. We are giving you direct orders. Well, in service, you take the last direct order. So I took a direct order, and I took the Jeep, and there I went. I got up there. There was a big house, and there was a big basement. The Germans burnt the house down, but you could still stay in the basement. The heat didn't bother them. The old man had his headquarters and everything in the basement, and the whole house burnt down. So I parked, and I run into the basement. He sees me. Oh, he give me hell. I told you not. So I run out, and that's when they hit my Jeep, and they knocked a tree down on it. And I get down, and I had to go down under a railroad track and put a spare tire on. I got back. The major and the captain was, they had their head dropped down. They'd already caught. But anyway, after we got cleared, the old man took over and got everything cleared and got the Germans gone, and we lost contact with them. I was going back to the motor pool, and the road going to the motor pool went right by this street where the lady said she had the liquor. So I stopped, and I went over, and I looked down in the basement. I saw the booze. So I didn't take any. I come back. Well, one of the MPs, which is our back guard, come and wrote me up for looting. Okay, so I go to the motor pool, come back, and they'd already give the ticket to my commander. They said they were going to court-martial me for looting. So anyway, the commander called me in and says, Corporal, let's take a drive. Let's go to the motor pool. So we head to the motor pool. On the way, he says, where's that liquor store? I said, okay. So we stopped. We get out, and he and I go over there, and we look and checked it and everything else. So we go to the motor pool. We come back. He calls in a lieutenant. Says, Lieutenant, take Corporal and go down and get some booze. I went down, and we loaded up some booze, brought it back, and he called some of his other people in. They had a party. But he threw my ticket in the file 13.
Were you ever concerned that you might be court-martialed?
Not as long as I was driving for the commander. Yeah.
A little more than a year from now. June 6th of next year will be 70 years, and I'm sure people will be talking about it. And they'll talk about it this June 6th as they do every year. When that day rolls around each year, what comes to your mind? What do you think back on?
I don't really think too much about it anymore with the way the things is, the economy, and the way the things are going over in foreign countries and stuff. I never know what's going to happen over there.
Well, do you think that's still a day that we should be remembering and marking the bravery of all those men who died that day?
Well, I think we should keep it in the back of our mind. I mean, it was a big loss. It was a big battle, and we came through, but we did lose a lot of good people. But we got a lot of other problems. I think it's going to be coming up that I hate to see it.
Well, I just want to thank you for serving our country. Thank you for having the courage to go back to some of those moments that aren't easy to talk about. Is there anything else that you want to tell us?
No, I think I talked enough.
And clearly, I think you at home could probably hear the emotion in his voice a few times when tears came to his eyes, and really the words wouldn't come out. That's how real it still is all these years later, and we so appreciate the courage, the willingness to go back there with us today. David McCoy of Hanford, California, our guest. Please join us again next Saturday for another edition of Hometown Heroes on KMJ.